Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt, and we're brought to you every week by the California 1020, 10 miles, 20 bands. Coming up on Sunday, February 15th, Del Mar Fairgrounds, Stancinitas, and back. Core Sports, the very best in women's athletic wear. Tripalooza, which is going to be my inaugural Endurance Sports Awards, coming up on Saturday evening, February 21st at the Hilton San Diego Mission Bay. That's tri-palooza.com. Our next guest, two-time Ironman world champion, legend, icon, you name it, he is all of the above, Mr. Chris McCormick. Macca, how the heck are you?
How are you, Bob? Geez, I'm getting used to this. You need to be my PR agent. You do the best intros. I need you to walk me through it. I'm getting old. I need you to do these big intros for me as I walk in the room. It'd be fantastic.
You know what? You need to have a ukulele player following you around and a accordion player. When you have that, that just gives you that a little extra oomph.
Oh, it's the edge we need. But we've done this a lot in the last few months.
We really have.
Yeah, it's been great.
We have, but the thing I want to do is especially for the new listeners to my new podcast, is just go through the career, because it's every time I go through it, it's sort of mind-boggling to me, everything you've accomplished. I'm sure, because you're doing day-to-day, you don't probably look back that often and go, man, it's been a pretty amazing journey. Talk a little bit about when, because you really didn't get into the sport, when you were in college? Is that when you first got into triathlon?
Yeah, I saw the sport for the first time in 87, but I watched the Hawaiian Ironman on television, and it's an Ironman race that you remember very well, but in my opinion, it's the best Ironman Hawaii of that era. It was the year that Mark Allen got caught by Dave Scott, and Dave ran past Mark to win his, I think, fifth Ironman title, past the car, and I was so, past the van, I was so...
That was the coolest thing.
By this. Yeah. Oh, it was the greatest race, the greatest coverage. It's just a fantastic coverage of that event. And I remember sitting at home with my mother and said, one day I want to do that race. And my younger brother and my older brother were watching it with me. And they both laughed. I said, come on, you can never do that. It's never going to happen. And that was really the first time that I'd ever seen a triathlon or thought about doing one. I was running through high school at the time, had aspirations of being an Olympic runner, so anything to do with endurance enthralled me. But then at that era, we had a young gentleman by the name of Greg Walsh,
yep,
who grew up in my town, that started to come on the scene within America. So he became a bit of a folk hero. In 89, he got third in Kona, and he was the guy that would come back to Australia, and I'd started riding my bike in 1990. I bought my first bike. I had just finished high school, and I'd ride with this guy, thinking, wow, this guy's going around the world conquering the world in this sport called triathlon. I want to do it, and that was sort of where it kicked off. I did my first race, my first duathlon in 1991. I was never a fantastic swimmer, but I surfed. And 92, I took the plunge and did my first ever triathlon, and was hooked ever since. And it was the best decision of my life. And I talk a lot when I speak to people about the influence of certain people that inspire you to take things up. And those iconic guys, Greg Walsh and Mark Allen, without meaning to, had such a huge influence on me wanting to become a triathlete, because they were guys I felt I could relate to. They were real and are inspiring, and it was without question they were the gentlemen that brought me here and kept me here.
So back then, it's not like you could go online and find out about events or watch these things. Really, you really couldn't watch them on TV until they showed the Ironman coverage in later, like a couple months after it happened. So we had to rely on magazines to find out about the great events. So you're looking through these triathlete magazines, or Australian triathlon magazines, and looking at St. Croix and Wildflower and Chicago and all these iconic events, obviously the Ironman. When did you decide, okay, I want to win all of these races?
Well, you looked, magazines were your lifeblood to the sport back then. You
that was it.
Them and coming from Australia, we had the Australian version of magazines, but we also had what we called imports, which was triathlete magazine from America, and the import was as valuable as gold. You'd pass one of those magazines around to your friends because you had one of these American mags that covered everything that was happening in the States, the St. Croix, as you said, and the Wildflowers and these races. And that was to me, I would read these magazines cover to cover and again and again. And I often have conversations now with some of the older guys, and I can quote their results from the late 80s and early 90s. They're like, how do you remember this? I'm like, mate, I read the magazine 50 times until the next month, you know. And,
yeah.
And it was a fantastic era in the sport, because it was so, you were so close to it because you were so passionate about it, and so you were close to it through the magazines. And I talk about writers like yourself and other people that used to write the stories. They were so imperative or so important that they captured what happened in the race, because for the people that weren't there, you lived through their words. So this is what happened on the bike. This is who led the swim out. This is what the actual results were. So, you know, I took the plunge and said, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to be a pro athlete. And my father shot me down and said, that's not going to happen. You're going to finish university and you're going to be an accountant. And even though that era in Australian triathlon was very, very solid, we had a lot of great guys doing great things around the world, and it was sort of the emergence of the sport within my country, my aspirations of pursuing professional triathlon were shot down by my dad. I had one opportunity in 1993. I qualified for the Australian junior team to go to Manchester in England for the fourth ever World Championships, the ITU World Championships. They started in 89 in Avignon. And I went across and got a taste of what the sport looked like outside Australia. And I was like, man, this is honestly all I want to do. What I'm reading in the magazines is true and more. And it's all I want to do. But, you know, my dad had other plans. And I did all the right things. I finished college. I took a job at Bankers Trust and sort of put my triathlon ambitions on hold to keep my mum and dad happy.
Sure.
So and I did that for 6 months until I quit my job and decided to throw it all in and head overseas and pursue a dream that was, you know, what ultimately became my life.
But it wasn't that simple, because like you said, education was everything in your family. Dad was, you know, you've got your degree, you've got this great job, you're overlooking, you know, Sydney Harbour, you're getting a paycheck every week, and you were miserable.
I was absolutely miserable. You know, my father, you know, I'm the middle child. I have an older brother and a younger brother, and my father didn't have the greatest education. So he was determined. I think his entire, I guess, measure of himself to some degree was ensuring that all his boys were tertiary educated, had something that he hadn't had. And he achieved that. So when I graduated from college, for him it was right, next thing is his job, and you get a good job. And I took a job at Bankers Trust, and he was ecstatic, you know, and so was my mother. They were both absolutely ecstatic. Here I was working in Bankers Trust as a banker in finance, looking over Sydney Harbour, hating my life. I was 22 and reading these magazines, and a lot of the junior guys had been racing within Australia were now leaving the shores and going to Europe and doing these triathlons, and I'm reading these magazines still about guys like Greg Bennett. He was 2 years in front of me, and thinking, man, I used to beat Greg. You know, I was good as Greg. I can do what Greg's doing. And that was ultimately, you know, after 6 months, I still vividly remember. It doesn't feel like that long ago, being on a train into work and deciding on the train, in a packed train, okay, this is my last day. I'm going to quit today. I'm just going to go overseas. And my first vision was not, I never imagined myself being a professional athlete. Really what I wanted to do was travel with my bike, race these events I'd read about in the magazines, make enough to survive and explore the world. You know, Australia is a long way away, and I just wanted to get out and see what was out there. And so I ultimately quit. I sold everything I had within a 2 week period. I bought an open-ended ticket to Europe. It took me 2 weeks to pluck the courage to tell my parents that I'd quit my job. And when I ultimately did, I said, Mom, Dad, I've quit my job. I live for Europe in 6 days, and I want to travel and be a professional athlete. And I thought my father would be livid.
Right.
They were a little disappointed, but I still remember vividly my dad saying, look, son, if you're going to do this, you do it properly. You know, go over there and be the best you can be in anything you do. That's all I've ever asked of you. And, I jumped on a plane and with an open-ended ticket and swore I wouldn't come home until I ran out of money, and I never...
You're still waiting to run out of money.
I'm still waiting to run out of money. I haven't been...
So when you're...
It's been a 20-year
you. What did your boss say? Because here you've got a good job, you're a young guy, you've only been there 6 months. He's probably thinking you're asking for a raise, and basically you're just saying, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I walked into his office, and you remember, you're the bottom of the tree, you know. I've just taken a job, so it's not as if I'm the bottom of the tree. And back then, you rarely even spoke to your boss. You know, you'd see him in the hallway, good morning, sir. And I remember I had to walk into the office and say, look, I just want to give you 2 weeks' notice. You know, and I was the newest guy in the office. And he said, can I ask why you're quitting? And I said, look, I want to be a professional athlete, a professional triathlete. And he laughed at me. He said, kid, you're a dreamer. Good luck with it. You can finish up on Friday. And I was like, oh, thanks very much. And it was such a relief, you know, when I finally did it. I remember thinking, wow, I've quit. And then this fear came over me. I've got to tell my parents.
Right.
And then I tell this story to a lot of the young juniors that when you're reading magazines, or nowadays they're reading the internet, and you have this dream of being a professional, it's so, so romantic and so beautiful and so nice when you're sitting at home and you're living it through other people's adventures. But when I jumped on that plane, And I took off, and I didn't know, I was on my own, I didn't know where I was going. I was going to France, but I had nothing organized, nothing. It was just, I want to get out. That was my only focus. I remember arriving in Singapore on the stopover to go to France, and this fear hit me, like, what happens when I get to France? You know?
How do I find out about the races? Where do I go? Where do I sleep?
When I get there, I don't speak this language, I haven't got anything planned, I've got $2,000. It's like... You know, I look at it now and think, man, it was brave. Like, it was really brave. And that's what passion can do. You know, it makes you just throw caution to the wind and take a chance. And I arrived in Paris. I was scared and alone. And I bought a magazine. I thought I'd find the first race. I flicked to the back of a magazine. There was a race in Orange in southern France. And I thought, look, I'll catch a train, a slow train, save on the night's accommodation, sleep on the train. I raced in Orange, and I won some money, a couple of thousand francs. And then the next day, there was another race in Avignon. And that's how I lived. I raced Saturday, Sunday. Every week, I was staying in hotels. I was doing runners on hotels, so I didn't pay bills. And it was just, at the time, it was so stressful but exciting. But now you look back older, and they were just amazing times in your life. And you know, within 6 months, I started to get my name established within Europe, and within 18 months, I was number one in the world, and just on 2 years into my career, I won my first world championship. But I hadn't been home in that entire period. I came home to Perth, Australia, to race the world in 97, and ultimately won the world championship in front of my father. And that was really the, Dad, this is what I do, you know, like, please accept that this is my life now. And my dad did, and that was really a turning point for me emotionally and physically, that, you know, my parents accepted this career choice and understood it, and it was full speed ahead from that point on.
What I love is when you won that world championship, there was a guy in 97 by the name of Simon Lessing who was the, you know, he was
the king.
He was the king, right? Five world titles, the king. The king, right? Yeah. He won everything. But when I look at your career, there's sort of a series of, you know, Simon Lessing, Norman Stadler, Peter Reed, Craig Alexander. You know, sort of there's people who didn't believe in you, and then there's people you needed to beat. And you, in a one-on-one situation, you'll figure out a way to get past somebody. So when you guys were in Perth and doing some pre-race training, you made sure that you were doing some pre-race training with Simon Lessing.
Yeah, I think, you know, Simon was quite difficult because he was such a... In my entire career, he's the one guy who had my measure. You know, my respect for the man was so huge. I think I raced Simon 20 times in my life. I beat him 4 times in my entire life. And he was just such an animal at Olympic distance racing. He was such an imposing figure within the sport. And I met him for the first time in 97, earlier in the year, and I was ranked number one in the world in 97.
Yeah.
I'd been winning the World Cups, and Simon hadn't been racing a lot of the World Cup racing early season. So I met this guy. He's the 96 world champion. I'd raced at 96 worlds, and he'd beaten me. And now 97's rolled around. I'm ranked world number one. And the way Simon would go about things was intimidation, you know, and create, because he was so good. He was so good.
No weakness.
And he was really the first true triathlete in the modern era where he could swim with the best, he could ride with the best, and he could run with the best. He truly had no weakness. And he really intimidated me. We were on the same French club. I was in Tricastin. He was racing for the pro team in that club called Assystème, and very, very intimidating guy. And we raced four or five times that year. I beat him once in a small race in Germany. And then by the end of the year, I was still ranked world number one, and we were going to meet in Perth. And we'd raced 2 weeks before Perth, and he beat me in a sprint finish. But I'd spent the last month training with him, because Simon worked the same way. Simon used to like to train with people and intimidate them in training. He did it with Brad Bevan. He did it with everyone. And so he opted to come and train with me, the world number one, and he used to tease me in training. But I thrived off that to some degree.
Because sure.
I used to realize that I can beat this guy. I no longer put them in as a god. And that was always my issue with guys. I would put them in this god status, that they were unbeatable. And in 97, in that race in Perth, I got off the bike. I felt that I was running the best I could, and I saw Simon's primary weakness was he was very tardy in transition between bike and run. And I thought if I could get 6 or 7 seconds on him, you know, it could be enough. He liked to lead, and so I attacked out of transition and hung on. It was Simon's first defeat in 4 or 5 years. In a major championship, and since Spencer had beaten him in 93, so it was a huge win for me, a huge win. Of course, Simon came back the next year in the champion years and picked a big fight. I learned a lot in my career from Simon Lessing. You know, a lot of people talk about me being, you know, as I aged in my career, you know, and intimidated to some degree, but I realised the power Simon Lessing had over me through sheer respect and intimidation.
Yeah.
And I really tried to carry that later in my career. But 97, as a career win, that ITU World Championships, my first ever World Championships, finishing the year ranked world number one, it was probably the most crucial point in my career, because it was a release for me with my family, that my dad accepted this career choice, started to understand that this sport had viability as a profession. And for me, it was letting go of that I was a good athlete. I wasn't a talent. You know, as a young kid, you're told, oh, you're talented. We're always talking about, can he do it? Will he do it? Is it possible? But, you know, as an athlete, it's all about execution, and you often doubt whether you can execute. You know, 97 showed me that if I got things right, execution was something I could do. I could get it right on the big days, and it gave me the confidence to push on and believe that I could have a true career in this sport.
You know, you mentioned your boss saying, you know, hey, you know, good luck with that. Go be a professional athlete. And then you've had different slights along the years. When you look at your, 26 months as number one in the world with ITU racing, ranked number three in the world. Olympics is first ever Olympics in Sydney, in your home country.
Yeah.
I'm sure you thought, there's no way I'm not going to be on that team. I'm number three in the world. And you got left off that team.
Yeah, that left off. That was probably the toughest time in my career. I'd lost my mother the year prior and to breast cancer, and
yes.
I had a real lull because I had such a dynamic 97, 98, 99 season. I took some time off, and my world ranking dropped from number one to number three because I'd lost my mother, so I stopped racing for 4 or 5 months. You know, I'd won the Australian Olympic selection races, but they opted that they believed that my head wasn't in the right place.
Did they think that way because you had lost your mom?
Yeah, and I wasn't following the routine. I look at it now, and I wasn't following the routine that they'd expected of me or that I'd laid out. You know, I'd lost my mom. I took some downtime. I didn't go to Europe with the Australian team. I opted to stay home, prepare it, stay at home with my dad, and just be close to my brothers. And
sure.
And I ultimately went to Canada and prepared and did the 99 Montreal Worlds. And I was a little bit off the pace. I mean, I was 12th and it was just a flat season. And then come 2000, when they opted for the team, they were asking the questions whether I was going to get over this. You know, I was just flat.
Sure.
I wanted time to do things my way, and that wasn't what they wanted at that period of time. And at the time, it was very, very difficult to deal with. I can look at it in a different light now. I sort of have a little bit more understanding. You know, it was our first ever Olympics. Triathlon was new to the game, and a lot of the athletes that qualified for the team used the system a lot better than I did. We had a clause in the selection policy that was called unfair, or it was basically a clause that said if you had an issue in an event, you could apply for you had a problem in the race, and
right.
They would only when that happened, they would look at your past results.
Right.
And a few of the athletes disadvantage clause, it was called. You were disadvantaged within the race. A couple of the athletes opted not dived in the water and pulled out and exercised disadvantage, and I opted not to do that, and ultimately I didn't play the game well enough and was overlooked. But at the time I struggled to get over it, but I can appreciate it now, because if that didn't happen, I would never have opted to chase
come to the US.
My career in the USA.
Yeah.
And the US changed my life. It reinvented. It reintroduced me to what I came to the sport in the first place for. Was, you know, you get lost in that World Cup to some degree under your federation's rule.
Politics.
And you forget why you're doing
crap.
It.
Yeah,
you forget why you're doing it. And I came back to the States. I met guys like yourself. And I was doing these events with 5,000 people in them.
Yes.
Not 100 going, mate, this is triathlon. This is, wow, I'm at Alcatraz. Wow, I'm in
Chicago. I'm in downtown. I'm in New York. I'm all these places. L.A. Yeah, I love
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
So, U.S., and when you come to the U.S., what, 3 years, 33 wins? I mean, you were racing with a little bit of anger.
I was definitely teed off that I didn't get on that Olympic team. I came to America. I had such a dynamic 2000 year. I didn't lose. I think I won 14 races in a row. And
yep.
A lot of the Americans were saying, who is this kid? But it was the Olympic year, so there was a lot of, amongst the pro athletes, are like, well, Mac is cherry-picking these American races because all the good guys are doing the Olympics. So I got really annoyed at that. And so in 2001, I really took the guys that had won the Olympics that came to America that year, and I picked on them.
Right.
And every chance I got, I raced them. And every time I got it, because I realized with the Americans, you put TV... You had TV cameras, you had press, so I realized I had a platform to communicate to tell people what I thought of certain things, and I
right.
thought I got ripped off by my federation, and now 2001's come around, I'm racing the Olympic champion,
yep.
I'm beating him in races, going, hey, this guy won the Olympics, and look, I just beat him by 3 minutes. Now, I didn't, at the time, I had no disrespect for the guy that won the Olympics, I was
right.
trying to make a statement to my federation, but I can understand now why a lot of the athletes are like, this guy's wrong with this guy, but it was a motivation that I needed, and I just really went about chasing athletes that had had success, because I felt by beating them would prove a point to my federation that they'd made a mistake, and that ultimately took me to 3 years being undefeated and taking out these guys and really launched my career in the States. And you know, the federation ultimately came back to me in mid-2002 and said, hey, we want you to come back for Athens. Can you do that? And I asked if they'd select me for the team. I'd won a few of the World Cups that year, and I was moving up the ladder again to world number three. And I said, look, if you pick me for the Athens team now, I'll deliver for you a performance in Athens. But I refused to get back into your system. And when they refused to do that, I said, well, look, I'm going to go to Ironman. I was relatively young. I was 29, just turned 29, and back then there was no 70.3. No. You either did ITU or you did Ironman.
Exactly.
You know, it's a very different era now. So when I ultimately decided to do Ironman in 2002, that was when the whole game shifted to me. It was like, you know what, this is all I've ever wanted to do. I'm going to embrace this life now and walk away from the Olympics. And it really became my Olympics.
What I love is how quickly, when you think about your move to Ironman, you went to Ironman Australia, and I'm sure because that was, you won. First time out, win.
Yeah.
You know, and then you win that race again. What, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. But at that point, I'm sure you're thinking, okay, this is pretty seamless. I handled this without a problem, and I'm going over to, you know, win the Ironman in Hawaii, because that's the biggie. That's the one I've seen on TV. And this guy, Peter Reed, has won it. Yeah, but I beat him by 9 minutes in Chicago. That guy can't stay with me. So that learning process of the Ironman Australia and Ironman Kona, two different things.
Oh, completely different things. And I cringe when I think back now at how, and two things, on how inexperienced I was, and how, where you think you know, I was on top of the world at one distance, and you have this belief that, there's two things. You have this ego that you can't ask too many questions because you feel like you should know.
Right.
And this other thing that it's swim, bike, run. You know, it's okay, it's a little longer, but it's swim, bike, run. And like you said, I'd raced Peter Reed a few times and in these Olympic distance and thumped him by 6 or 7 minutes. So I just thought, well, this is four times as far. I should beat him by half an hour. How is this guy the world champion? And my first time I did a half Ironman, and I try and explain this to the young guys now, there used to be 10 Ironmans in the world.
Total.
So to win an Ironman, yeah, total 10. Like,
yeah.
And I try and explain this to someone, you know, I meet some of these young kids now that have won 10 Ironmans, and they compare themselves to the Peter Reeds that have won 12 and 13. I'm like, mate, Peter Reed won 12 Ironmans when there was 10 in the world, mate.
And the field was chock-a-block. Everybody was there.
Totally. Everyone was at a race. Like, it's like winning 10 regional championships nowadays. Like, you know, the guy won 20% of the world's Ironmans every year. You've got to understand how good this guy was. And so when I did my first half Ironman in Wildflower, 2001, I broke the course record. I beat Peter Reed and all these guys. I thought, this half Ironman, this is good. And I did my first Ironman in 2002.
What did you carry with you in 2001?
Yeah.
What, did you have, like, well, one gel and you had one water bottle?
I had two gels, and because in an Olympic distance race, I used to have a single gel. And this is what I look back and I cringe at, because I had no idea. So my whole philosophy was, in an Olympic distance race, I have one gel.
Yep.
Two and a half Ironman, I'll just double the distance,
yep,
twice the amount of food. Two gels, and I'll have two drink bottles. I'll just take one on the course. I couldn't believe that they swapped out drink bottles in the race. I thought, this is fantastic. I don't need to take anything. They're going to give me stuff out there. And when I did my first Ironman, which I won, I had four gels.
Because you doubled
four
it again.
Gels.
Yeah.
Because I doubled again. Like, that was how ludicrous it was, and how far off the mark I was to some degree. But it was also reflective of how raw I was, I guess, as an Ironman racer, and how there was so much more to learn, and that's where Ironman taught me so much. But I did 2002 in Australia against the Peter Reeds and there was Olivier Bernard, Chris Lee, Thomas Helwig, all these guys have won world championships.
Right.
And they've come to my Ironman in Australia, my debut, and I've won this event and just missed the record. I'm thinking, mate, of course I'm going to win Hawaii. I haven't lost a race in 3 years. I've done one Ironman, I've won it. I've done one half, I've won it. These guys are the world champions. So when I turned up to Kona in 2002, I annoyed a lot of people because I was asked, how do you think you're going to go? I'm like, well, I'm going to win.
Right.
Like, of course I'm going to win. Like, why would I not win? And these questions were being asked of me. I had no idea that I was annoying so many people because in my head, you know, I was asked questions whether I needed to pay my dues. In my head, I'd watched Hawaii 10, like I knew Hawaii Ironman at the back of my hand because I'd watched every single coverage of that race. I could quote interviews. I knew what the energy lab was, but I'd never been there. I knew all about a leaky dry, but I'd never run on it. I knew all about the heat and the humidity, but I'd never felt it. But I could tell you every single piece of history about it.
And so you knew the music that was in the backdrop too, right? Mm-hmm. When you're watching it on TV and you were, you know, and you knew that it was.
They cut an 8-hour, an 8-hour race into 2 hours of beautiful coverage, and that was, it was a real eye opener. I swam hard. I had a 13-minute lead off the bike. I rode with Thomas Hellriegel and Jürgen Zach. I ran out of transition 13 minutes up on the best guys in the world and high-fived my father and said, I'm going to win Kona. I'll see you in 2 hours and 40 minutes because that's what Mark Allen ran.
Yeah.
Within 5 miles, I was walking. By 10 miles, I was out. It was the most humiliating. And this is no joke. I was going up Pulani Hill at 10 miles in this race. And, you know, I'd made a lot of noise about me winning this event. You know, I'd gone around the island. You don't realize how small Kona is until you're there race week. And there's a lot of noise about this cocky Australian kid who had done one Ironman and won it and was claiming he was going to win Kona on debut. And as I was walking up Pulani Hill and Tim DeBoom and Peter Reid ran past me, Tony DeBoom, Tim's brother, stepped out right in front of me on the course. And I was walking. He said, hey, welcome to Kona, you punk. And I remember thinking, wow, okay, I've upset a lot of people here. And it was a learning curve. It really, really was a learning curve. And I honestly can tell you with the utmost honesty that I am so glad, if I had to write my career again, I am so glad that it went that way. Because had I won in 2002, I would never have truly appreciated the enormity of this race, how important this race is in everything to do with this sport, in its history, in how it shapes athletes, how it breaks athletes, how it haunts athletes. And had I won it that first year, it would never have meant as much as it did when I ultimately won it.
Similar to Mark Allen. You know, and Greg Welch. It's that struggle. Yeah. It's failing and then coming back and dedicating yourself to getting it right. So 2002, the DNF with the big lead. And then 2003, you finish it, but it's like, what, 9.5 hours? You're 59.
Yeah.
You're walking the marathon course, which is, you know, basically the best triathlete in the world. That's hard to do, I'm sure. But were you pretty much resigned to the fact that no matter what happens, I'm getting to the finish line this year?
In 2003, well, I never realized how important, because I didn't know that. You know, in Olympic distance racing, you didn't have a good day, you stepped off, and you race next week. And so in Kona, it was like, oh, okay, it's not going well.
Yeah.
I'll come back next year and I'll win. And I got absolutely crucified. I had never really taken the time to appreciate what Ironman was. You know, what this race meant to people.
Yeah.
I'd always looked at it as a performance. I need to win this event. There'd never been a question on who did it, why people did it. I only wanted to do it because Mark Allen did it, and I wanted to be him. I never understood that this race was about the journey. It was about the event. So when I stepped off, I got crucified. Like, and so in the following year, when I came back, I thought, no matter what, I'm finishing this race. And again, I had the most unbelievable season. This is what was the most frustrating thing on all my Ironmans. I would have these unbelievable seasons, like I'd win everything and fall apart in Kona. And it's funny how you emulate, or without meaning to, your heroes, because that was Mark Allen.
Right.
We would win everything, fail in Kona. Repeat the next year, fail in Kona.
Yeah.
Repeat the next year, fail in Kona. And that's what continued to happen. But in 2003, I walked to the finish, 9:30, finished 78th place. In 2004, I retired on the course. I stepped off. And going into the energy lab, I was in fifth place. I jumped into the car, and that was when I jumped in with Mark Allen. I retired from Ironman. I said, I cannot do this race. I'm too big. I can't do it. And I pleaded with Mark to give me some guidance. You know, I'd just broken 8 hours in Germany for the first guy to do it for years, the first non-European. I'd won Australia again. I just had this most ridiculous season, and again, I'd faltered in Kona. And Mark had gave me the time that day. He was coaching Peter Reid, who went on to win, and he gave me the time and just told me to start assessing what I was doing with my season. I can't win everything. And to understand that Hawaii comes at the end of the year. It's about being the best in October. No one cares about who's the best in January or the best in April. You know, your whole season is dictated by who is the best in October. And what makes this race so difficult is it's an end-of-season race, you know, so you have to carry a season or survive a season and then perform well in October. And I needed to, he believed I needed to assess what I was doing in the year. I was racing way too much and being too aggressive all year, and I needed to relook at things. And his exact words would be fat in July, you know, and build through. And I took that on board, and the following year I was sixth.
Yeah.
And then
when you took sixth, that was the Thomas Hellriegel year. You're out on the bike,
yeah,
and you're,
yeah,
you've bonked again, and you're retiring again, right? And
yeah,
then you're with the Great Ten. Meanwhile, the thing is, a lot of times people, you, power meters, science, all that type of stuff, you went and analyzed your body, had your body analyzed to figure out, okay, how can I deal with the heat? What should I drink? What should I eat? You were bringing in the best minds there were. But at the end of the day,
yeah,
Thomas Hellriegel probably gave you the best advice there was.
Well, when I was sitting there with Mark Allen, I'd taken Mark Allen on board in 2004. I listened to him. I thought, you know what? I'm going to be the most professional triathlete there is.
Yeah.
2005, I accessed the Australian Institute of Sport, which were the greatest sports science minds in my country. I had my body probed and probed and worked out how much sweat I had and what my salt ratios were, and I got given this perfect nutrition plan. So I remember being armed for Kona, thinking, now they're all dead. You know, I've got this engine now, I've got the perfect fuel, they're all dead.
Yeah.
And mate, I'd never been so far behind. I was vomiting the entire race, and I was out towards Harvey, and I'd given up. I'm like, mate, I cannot do this race. It's me. You know, I'm feeling sorry, I'm throwing up. And I was specifically told to stay clear of simple sugars, Coca-Cola, those sort of things, and just follow this electrolyte drink supplement I'd had and this carbohydrate supplement I had to take on board. And Thomas Hellriegel rolled up to me and had a flat tire. I'm 20 minutes behind Faris Al-Sol time, the furthest I'd ever been behind in a race. And I quit. I'm sitting up on the bars, I'm throwing up, and Thomas rolled up and said, hey, man, you need to get back to transition. Stop drinking your drink. Just drink water and Coke and ride with me. I said, nah, Thomas, I'm out. He's like, come on. No. He said, what was that word? He said, no, there's no refunds today. No refunds today, mate. There's no refunds. Finish the race.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh. I said, all right. So I started riding with him. He said, drink Coke. Just drink Coke and water. Too much of it. So the next aid station I come up, mind you, every sports scientist I've just seen, but do not touch Coke. Do not drink water. You got to drink this.
Yeah.
I'm like, threw my drink bottles, and I started just drinking Coke and water from the 90-kilometer mark of the Ironman. I end up riding 8 minutes quicker than anybody for the second 90 kilometers of the bike course. I got off 12 minutes behind Faris I posted the fastest run of the day. I ran myself into six. I ran past everybody. I crossed the line. And I felt magnificent. Every other year in Kona, I'd collapsed across the line. I failed to finish, and I posted the fastest marathon. I crossed the line. I felt healthy.
Yeah.
And I'd only drunk Coke and water from that point on. So obviously all the sports scientists have rung me up saying, oh, look, we've got that nutrition right. I'm like, guys, you know, like, come on, everything you told me to do, I didn't do, and it went well. And that was when I realized I need to be a little bit more flexible, but it also gave me the confidence that, you know what, this race is about working the storms, working the difficult sections, staying engaged mentally,
yeah,
and physically you're engaged as long as you're mentally engaged. You need to stay mentally in this game. And that was the race I took some confidence that I could perform well there and back my run. I'm a runner, where the run had always scared me in the marathon because I was yet to post the big run times. But that day I thought, you know what, I can do this. And I changed my entire racing tact, how I would attack this event. And I decided then that I was always going to back my marathon. And ultimately the following year I came back and executed that strategy.
Perfectly, because you ran 2:46, 71 seconds back. And what I love is a lot of times when someone finishes second, 71 seconds back, they'll go, you know, if there was another mile, I would have had him. But Norman Stadler was having a great day, and you knew in that last mile, you were just happy to get to the finish line.
Oh, I threw everything at Norman. It was the first time my plan was to swim well, to ride with the group, and I never realized Norman would be so. No, I never expected Norman to be so close out of the water. He was in front very early in the race, and he had, I think, 11 and a half minutes on us off the bike, and I thought that was enough. I was confident that I could run a 2:45.
Yep.
I'd run 2:49 the year before, and And that was the plan. And I got off and I started running at him. And I executed the perfect race for me. I could not have done... I did everything right.
Yep.
I did everything I trained to do. And I was beaten by a better guy who put in an amazing performance, the best of his career. You know, he'd just ridden the bike course record and ran his best marathon time in Kona to win the race. And a lot of people had said after that race, you were catching him, you were catching him. If it was another 2 miles or another mile, you would have won the event. I'm like, look, guys, another mile, I wouldn't have made the finish line. I had nothing left to give. I ended up in the medical tent with two IVs. I had my father standing over me. My second daughter, Sienna, was just born. My father standing over me going, son, what are you chasing? You don't need this race in your life. You don't need it. And I'm like, Dad, I'm coming back, you know. But Norman really, really intimidated me, because up to that point in my life, and whenever I'd had a race like that, the perfect race, athletes call it, I'd always won.
Right.
And I had the perfect race and finished second.
Yeah. So now you're gearing up for 2007. But, you know, before that, I mean, again, you're resting, you're in the glow of this amazing race. We're at the post party, and all of a sudden someone pulls out a BlackBerry and was like, wow, look what Norman said. Norman's sort of slamming you for, you know, sitting in on the bike, and you wouldn't have been that close, and all sorts of things like that. Now, I had seen, you know, I was there through the whole Mark and Dave thing, and those guys weren't buddies, but I never saw it get to the point where it almost came to blows. This was probably one of the coolest things I've ever seen. The Under Armour guys were over there for the first time. We're all at this the Kona Brewing Company, I think it was, and it got a little tense there when you saw the article. What was your reaction?
I was devastated, because honestly, it was the first time in my life that I was absolutely ecstatic with second place. I'm standing there on a stage, going, you know, I'm the happiest I've ever been.
Yeah.
I'm standing on the stage of my idols. I'm second at the Hawaiian Ironman World Championships. I've just given everything I got. The guy who beat me, I'm accepted he's the better athlete. And then I come off the stage, and I realized something was wrong when I was up on the stage. And I remember Norman going around shaking everybody's hand. Farris was quite cold with me, who was the previous year's champion, who had finished third. And Norman came along, and I remember him stopping at Kabiki, who had finished fourth, and saying, brave race today. In my opinion, you're the best runner in the field. I heard him. He was only earshot away from me. I mean, it's a strange statement. Oh, they must be friends. Again, I'm naive and dumb.
Yeah.
And he comes up and he sort of shakes my hand quite cold, does his speech. As I come off the stage, I get given a BlackBerry by Brian Lavelle, and I read this article that Norman's done, and he is absolutely unleashed on me. And I was mortified. I couldn't believe it. My first reaction was, where is this guy? And I've known Norman since 93.
You guys were juniors, yeah.
We're juniors together. So I'm like, mate, why would you say this stuff? Where is he? You know, I want to find this guy. And you know, I just signed this deal with Under Armour, who are an American football company, so I'm trying to be on my best behavior. But I'm absolutely livid on the inside. And I'm like, you know what? I was getting angry and angry, and people are reading it going, mate, because I'd read just this first part of the article, and other people are reading the ends of the article going, he also said this. And I'm like, oh, my God. I got really angry. And, you know, I ultimately hunted him down at the Kona Brewing Company at the after party, and it was a little bit like, I remember walking in, I think you were there, Allen was there, and I walked in, I walked over to Norman and said, can I speak to you for a second? And he was, you know, he's the champion, he had his big entourage with him, all these people, he's like, if you have something to say, you say it to me here, and I unleashed. I said, what's the go? And I can't believe you would say this, and I said, look, Norman, you know, and he had some good lines. I said, what's your problem? You know, I can't, why would you say this? You know, and I said, I'm going to retire you from the sport. I want to retire you from triathlon. I will race you anywhere, anytime you want to race. Pick a race, Norman, I will race you. He said, the race was yesterday and I won. With the exact words, I have two titles, you have none.
Yeah, that's what he said to me. He says, the scoreboard, Norman Stadler 2, Chris McCormick 0.
And I was like, yeah, but I didn't have a problem with you yesterday. And it ultimately fired up, and I said, I'm going to retire you from triathlon. My entire aim in this life is to race you at every chance I get, and I'm going to beat you. You can have your night tonight, But I swear to you, and I yelled at everyone in the crowd there, yep. and then I said, everybody listen to me. I'm going to retire this man from triathlon. You will never beat me again. And if you do, I will walk from the sport. And I said, now where's Farris? I told the same to Farris. And that really kicked off that huge 07 year with the angry rivalry between
yes.
the three of us.
That was the best.
Really, yeah, it was a very intimidating. I remember my wife saying to me, I needed to calm down. She's like, you're losing the plot here. And but for me, the pressure of 07 was enormous because this had gone on, and I'd gone and picked fights with these guys all over the world. I was racing them left, right, and center and beating them and then making a big scene out of it. And I really fed off this energy. And in 07, I remember waking up for the race in Kona. And without sounding melodramatic, if I didn't win that year, my career was done. Yeah. Because I'd gone above and beyond. I'd gone too far in the attack of the champion. And it ultimately went my way. And to Norman's credit, he met me at the finish line, and we made peace. We absolutely made peace. And to this day, we're still very, very good friends. But it was a lovely rivalry. I enjoyed it.
Well,
I really fed off it.
Yeah, when you think about it, again, the slight from the Olympic Committee, your boss telling you, what the hell are you thinking? You're that type of person. You like when people doubt you because you like to prove them wrong. So during that summer, you would look at the schedule and see where Farris and Norman were racing, and that's where you would go.
Yeah, I actually told them that. I remember in early it was early January, I saw that Farris had signed up for an event in Dubai.
Yeah,
and I saw he'd signed up, so I jumped on an airplane. I flew up without him knowing I was coming. I turned up to the press conference, walked in and said, hey, champ, you didn't know I was coming, did you? And I ended up beating him. I remember crossing the finish line and waiting for him for like a few minutes with my clock on.
Yeah.
And as he arrived at the finish line, I'm like, 3 minutes, beat you. I told you I was going to beat you. It was as much a game for me as it was a... It wasn't a game. I needed that motivation because
sure.
Norman had beat me up. In 2006, Norman beat me up fair and square. So a lot of people go, why were you going on like this? I was scared.
Yeah.
I was scared of this guy. I was now my fifth year into Kona. I hadn't won the title. He was right. He'd won two. I'd won none. It's the guy making a lot of noise. And Mark Allen once said it to me, right, you'll hear, in your career, Chris, you're going to hear about all these guys who can win Kona. But guess what? You're going to go through and you're going to see these generations of guys who don't, you know, and there's a lot of them that don't win it.
Right.
You know, and we're going to find out if you're one of those guys. And there's a lot of great ones that don't. And so I was scared. And that motivated me to pick this fight, to stay engaged and focused on these guys, to intimidate them, for them to think, oh, my God, because I was a good athlete and they knew that. And I really wanted them to think, man, this guy can win it, and he's a little bit crazy, and he's a little bit loopy, and ultimately have them second guess themselves, which they ultimately did.
Sounds a little Muhammad Ali-ish.
It really was. It really was. It was the approach we took. And Emma, it's the only time in my life my wife has pulled me aside and said, "You need to stop. This is too much." And I sat her down and said, "Darling, this is really my life." Like, this is my life. It's not a joke. You know, a lot of people watch and write about it and talk about it, but to them it doesn't matter if I win or I don't win. They'll write about the person who does. And
sure.
But to me, it matters. It's my life, and I have to do this. And, it ultimately went the right way. And I often think now, had it not, what would have happened? My career was done. It was finished. That 07 was so nerve-wracking, so emotional,
right,
that when I knew I had it won, you know, the last, I had a flawless race, an absolutely flawless race, and when I knew I had it won, the relief of it, everything was huge. I don't remember it. I do not remember the win. I just remember doing everything right. You know, I didn't even take the sponges out of my finish
right
photo. People are like, what are you thinking? I said, I wasn't thinking.
It was
just a relief.
Yeah.
You know, it was an absolute relief.
When I look at that, there was another moment during that summer where I think you were racing Challenge Roth, and I think Norman was doing the commentary. And he was in a van. And meanwhile, the whole thing with Muhammad Ali and Sonny Liston, he got into his head. And, you know, Sonny Liston, the one thing that scares a bully is a crazy person. And you were the crazy person that summer, right? And so you're riding along, leading the race, and Norman's doing TV, and you're yelling at the guy.
Yeah, well, I used to always go to Germany. I liked going to Europe and racing, which a lot of the guys don't do now, but I used to enjoy going to Europe and racing the Europeans at home, because I really believe the Europeans race their best at home. And there, after 07, of course, it was the big rival, after 06, the big fight between Norman and I. So obviously the big German races, Roth and Frankfurt, wanted to get us in a showdown within Germany. And I ultimately decided to race Roth again, and Norman decided to do Frankfurt. So we didn't meet each other in Germany. Ultimately, the showdown was going to be in Kona.
Right.
But Norman was the world champion, so he had to commentate the Roth event for live on German television. So I'm leading this race. I'd stated that I was going to go for the world record. And I'm off the front on the bike, and I'm chasing this world record alone. And I had good legs. Everything was fine. I felt fantastic. And I'd had a really good season up to then, and I'd beaten Norman a couple of times in Germany prior to this event already, and Farris. And I'm having a great day, and I'm on world record pace. And he did a cross. He was in the back of a van, a truck, and a live TV cross with me in the background as the backdrop, and he's covering it live on television. And as I'm riding, I'm yelling at him as he's talking. I said, "Hey, Norman, Norman. You, hey, Norman," and he turned around in the middle of the live TV, and he looked at me. I said, "Are you watching this? Are you watching this? You watch me, mate, because in 15 weeks, you're going to be racing it, and it's a big difference. You know, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to smash you. And I could see in his face that day, he's like, what is wrong with this guy? Like, this guy has gone above and beyond, and it really, for me, it was as much intimidating, and he's the world champion. You know, like, this is the world champion I'm yelling at and screaming at. It was very, I mean, melodramatic, but Ali Liston picking a fight with this guy, making this guy think, what have I done? And then when I won the race, I just missed the world record. The following week, he was racing Frankfurt. So I extended my ticket and thought, you know what? I drove up to Frankfurt, stood on the sideline, and heckled him as he raced. When he was racing, I went to the press conference, heckled him in the press conference.
Did you really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then when he was running, he had a really bad day. He was going backwards. I'm like, oh, please. You're the champ? Come on, champ. You're fifth. You want to win the world and you can't even win your national championships? Oh. Give me a break. I heckled him, and Farris just did not let up on these guys all year. And Farris's mother, after that race, sent me an email begging me to stop harassing her son. That's when my wife was like, "Chris, you need to calm down." But, to me, it was the only way to keep me engaged and keep me fearful of the enormity of what 2007 was to my career, because I'd won everything, but I hadn't won Kona, and I'd made a lot of noise, and I got close, and a lot of guys had got close, but it was to define my career if I didn't win it in 07, and the task was enormous, and that's why I really wanted to keep myself engaged in fear and paranoia and have them second guess themselves.
So when you win this thing, and you know what I love about it, Farris dropped out the night before. Norman's puking during the bike ride, and he's out. I'm imagining some of that intimidation affected their preparation going into that race. But you win the race, you run a 2:42 marathon. There's a guy in second place by the name of Craig Alexander. And the next couple of years, he wins. So here, you finally win this race. And I'm sure, rather than exultation, there was probably more relief when you won that race. Almost like, okay, I guess I can stay in the sport for a while longer.
Yeah. It was, so when I won, it was like, oh, I did it. And it was the most emotional win. I remember thinking, I told my brother I'd win it. I told my mother I'd win it. And I've finally done it.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Crowey, as you said, came along second. I'd raced Crowey my entire life. I knew Crowey. I knew he was a phenomenal athlete, but he was new to the Ironman game. No one expected him to have that sort of success so quickly. And I never really saw Crowley as a super threat. So I thought, you know, my only rival at that point really was Stadler. And I felt like I'd got rid of him. So I'm like, beautiful. I can walk away from triathlon if I wanted to, but I don't have to. There's really no peers. I've got no one who can really beat me. And, you know, Crowley came along and in 08, I had some issues. He won his second ever Kona. He's won, and then I thought, okay, I had a mechanical problem that put me out of the race. I figured, well, that doesn't count, Crowley. You won, but you won by default. That's how I justified it to myself.
Right.
You know, you won because I had a problem.
Right.
So you can borrow my title, and I'll come back in 2009, and I'll get my title back. It's mine. You know, it's not yours. You're borrowing it. And you know, I created a rift with Crowley that I didn't really mean to create. And it just did. It was, you know, and I completely understand from Crowley's perspective how I did that unintentionally. But it was, that again was cool. And in 09, I raced Craig, a match race, really, and he beat me fair and square. I did everything right again. I had some issues on the run, but everyone has issues in Ironman, and he capitalized on that with the boys and won his second title, the first man to defend since the boom, and he became a legend. And I was like, you know, this guy has two titles. I've got one. We're both from the same country. Wow, what happened? What happened? What happened here? In the blink of an eye, I've gone from the champ to
chop liver.
Go away.
Yeah,
chop liver. And it was very, very quick.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, wow. And I felt the sport. It was, you know, 2 years is nothing, especially at the peak, and you still feel like you're very competitive. And I was fourth. I wasn't out of the action, and I was a competitive fourth. I'd had a bad swim. I had a magic bike ride. I had a very good run with some problems, but I had to put it together to finish fourth.
Yep.
But Crowley, people are blinded by.
You win.
They watch. Watch results. They don't watch races.
Right.
They saw this two-time champion. Mac is done. These guys are done. There's a new king. All hail the new king. And that was understandable. But I just felt that it wasn't fair. And I promised my wife that I was going to retire in 09 when I won the second time because she was exhausted from the Norman era and now this new Crowley era. She's like, I've had enough of this. Can we please just be normal? And then we sort of walked away in 09 and she realized I wasn't happy. And she gave me the blessing to chase it in 2010. And I knew Crowley. You know, Crowley's a guy, he was my training partner for years. We'd semi-grown up together. He trained with me for Australia for most of my ITU career. So I knew Crowley. Even though the sport saw him as a two-time world champion, to me, he's Crowley.
Right.
As I'm just Macca to him. You know, we're friends. You know guys' strengths and weaknesses by training with them. And so I believed I could beat him. And it wasn't as if it was some young hotshot kid that was doing everything that I couldn't do. And so when I came out in 2010 with you in Auburn, Alabama,
yes,
and I said, hey, I want to beat Craig Alexander, and this is how I'm going to do it. And I stated exactly how I was going to do it. People thought, just shut up, mate. Go away. What's wrong with this guy? Long live Crowley. You know, you can't beat this guy. It's impossible. But I really studied what I believed needed to happen, how Craig had won two titles and how I believed I could beat him and how I had to beat him and needed other people to beat him. And that's what we started doing.
Right.
And that sort of got kicked off when we were in Auburn, Alabama.
It did, because we were walking on the field there and saying, so how do you beat Craig Alexander? And you said, listen, Craig is a front-of-the-pack swimmer. He's going to be with us out to Kauai High on the bike. He's a strong cyclist.
Yes.
If we don't attack him, and you looked at the camera and said, Timo, Norman, Ferris, we need to attack Craig, because if he has a weakness of any sort, it's where the bike gets hard, we have to attack. So on the way to Javi and the way back from Javi, crosswinds, headwinds, we have to get away, because if he's with us when we get back to Kauai High, he'll be with us when we get back to Kona and the race is over, because he's the best runner in the heat that there is. So,
yes.
You know, you laid it out, but, you know, people did take it pretty personally. I know Crowley was not happy with me or with you, But the reality was that you sort of laid out a plan, not saying everybody's got weaknesses. Everybody has strengths and weaknesses. So the race seemed like it played out that way.
Yeah, and you draw off the assumption. I also draw off the assumption, look, you've won a title the same way 2 years in a row. You've executed the best run. Why would you change a winning formula?
Right.
Why would you change? So you have to make the assumption that people will not implement change unless it's forced upon them.
Right.
You know, so I said, look, Craig's going to execute the same race strategy. Why would you change it? So, guys, we cannot allow this guy to get off the bike with us. And if he has a weakness, it's in that windy section when the runners are trying to conserve to keep their run legs. So let's be aggressive. They're going to watch their power numbers. Craig rides power, stays in his power zones. He'll let his power peak and go outside those zones, but he won't like it out there. He'll make a conscious decision to let go. And once that decision to let go, he's going to back off, stay in his zones, and back his marathon. We've got to be aggressive. And that's going to happen in the crosswinds, because that's when the power numbers are going to be, the demands on power are going to be the highest. So let's make the attacks then. Now, people talk about me going around the world and grabbing, you know, Marino van Oonacker and saying, hey, we've got to get together. I never had those conversations with anybody. I basically had a conversation that explained to them exactly what I just said to you then. Guys, think about it. You know, you're doing 758 races here in Europe. You are good enough to win Kona. You have to make the assumption that everybody wants to win Kona. So if you point out the best way or the best chances for all of us to win, then the majority is going to go with the best chance that makes them win. A lot of people don't really think about it. So when I went to the guys that I thought had similar strengths to me, and I told them, this is the way we beat Crowley, think about it, I assume they would go back to their coaches and think, you know what, this guy's right. And sure enough, it played out that way. Crowley talks about me getting 10 guys together and working together. This never happened. It was just the guys realized that what I was saying was correct, and when they made the move there, Crowley did exactly what he would do if he, because that's what had won in the race 2 years in a row. And he let the gap go when we attacked him. The gap opened up. We were able to grab the lead and extend the lead, because now all the horsepower, the big bike riders, are now all in the same group. And he stuck with the weaker bike riders. And the gap was going to open up, and the margin of error would be too big. And we could ultimately win the race without having to run the fastest marathon. And that's exactly how it panned out, except it was the dawning of the next wave of kids, because Andy Raylert came along and gave me the race of my life. I think the 2010 race for me with Andy was, you know, and funnily enough, I had Andy staying here in Thailand with me at the moment. We're talking about the event today, and it was the masterpiece race for me, because I was able to work out how to beat an iconic racer in Craig Alexander and beat the next wave of athletes in Andy Raylert. And at a point in my career where I was happy with the win and happy with my family to walk away, really, from, you know, this was it for me. 2010, I'm done with super competitiveness in Kona. And it was just the perfect event.
It was almost, when you compare it again to Muhammad Ali, it was almost the rope-a-dope. It was almost that was your rope-a-dope race, because you were, you know, you're towards the middle to the end of the career. You're using your guile rather than your raw talent. And so you come off the bike and you've got, what, 8 minutes or so on Crowley. So he's pretty much done. But you're running along and you're getting reports, and Andreas Raylert is coming. And as you're hearing those reports, there's two things to do. One is, okay, I got to pick up the pace. I can't let this guy catch me. Or it's, am I better off fueling up, getting ready for when he catches me, because it's going to happen, and then use my tactics and my background to beat this guy in the last mile or two?
Yeah, and for the entire race, we were never more than 2 minutes apart. And you know, when we got rid of Crowley, coming back up from Harvey, and we turned back onto the Queen K, heading back towards Kailua Kona, we're 60K out. At that point, we're about 5 or 6 minutes up on Crowley and his group. And I thought, okay, we need to look at who's in this group now. Who's here? who can run. There was Bruck, who was a good runner, but I felt that I could outrun Bruck because I'd raced him a lot in Europe. But it was Andreas Rehler who had won Frankfurt that year. And I was in that race in Frankfurt, and he didn't just win it.
Oh, yeah.
He absolutely destroyed us. It was we were in another postcode, when this guy finished the race. It was an unbelievable performance. And so I'm thinking, I need to sit behind Rehler. He's the guy I'm fearful of here. And he looked a little fragile, you know, coming back. He'd done a lot of work early on the bike, and so I attacked him about 30K from home and got a little bit of a margin of error. I ended up coming to transition about a minute up on the group. And as I got off, I thought, I'm going to run this, set this tempo and run like I'm the champion. Right. You know, I used to always try and tell myself, be Mark Allen, be the champ. Run with that presence, be that confident. And so when I ran along a leaky drive, I tore out a transition, and I knew Andy was he's this new age athlete that just was a fearless racer. He's like a team layers now. They're fearless. They just lay it out there, and he would chase. And he did. So, you know, after about 8 miles, I'd set this blistering pace, but he just matched it. And I started to get a little tired, you know, about 10 miles, and I was starting to lose about 10 seconds a mile. I realized, look, the kid's going to catch you. You know, let's just relax, focus, and concentrate. To win this race, you just need to be first back to the pier. So I used to say to myself, first back to the pier wins. You don't have to be first to the energy lab. You don't need to be first back to that pier. And, you know, I consciously relax. I thought, I'm going to take some fuel in, except he's going to catch him. And he catches you, at least you can see him. And we can try and intimidate him or at least race him when we're side by side. I can see what's going on. And I'd expected him to make the catch as I came out of the energy lab with about 6 miles left to run. I was doing the math in my head, working out how much I was losing per mile. And when I came out of the energy lab, he hadn't caught me. I actually looked back for him going, wow, he's human.
Yeah.
You know, and those little positive boosts, they seem so small, but you know, he's hurting too. You know, take so much energy from that. I said, see, he is hurting. This is hard for him. Because they're the things that you're fearful of. They're the things that you question in a race. You always feel everyone else is doing it easy and you're doing it hard. And so I thought, that's a great thing. And it took him another 3 miles to actually catch me. So I remember thinking, I'd expecting to run 6 miles with this guy. I'm only going to run 3 miles with him. This is great. Everything was positive, you know. And when he ultimately caught me, I remember looking at him and I said, I'm just going to be the alpha male. I'm just never going to let him run past. No matter what it takes, I just always be one step in front, one step in front. Talk down to it, not down to him, but if I come to an aid station, I'm going to be first in. Just really lay my authority. I'm the alpha male here. You've had to catch me. And it sort of played out that way. I made a couple of moves on him and tested him out. And was getting his gaps. I realized he was tired. I was very tired. But at that point in an Ironman, in any long course race, everybody emotionally and physically exhausted. And any little bit of positiveness you can find can change your day. Because everything at that point can be so negative because you're so drained and emotional and exhausted. And I was looking for any, you said it right, it's experience. I was looking for any bit of positivity. And I'd made a move on him up the hill as we turned to Palani. He'd actually caught up again. But I remember how long it had taken him to catch 10 seconds up. So he caught 10 seconds up very quickly after I'd made a move on him. And as we turned down Palani Hill, we had, I think, 2 kilometres to go. But, you know, and I heard him, as we're coming down the hill, start calling for fuel. He yelled for Coke and water at this aid station. It's not really an aid station you need to take anything from. You're home by then, you know. He's like, Coke, water. And when he said Coke, I remember thinking, you only drink Coke when you're tired. You only drink Coke when you're tired. If he goes for Coke, I'm going. And as we came into the aid station, you can watch it, I remember thinking, this guy needs fuel. I'm going to be first to the aid station, and I'm going to take those cups, which is, you know, I'm going to grab the water. He needs it, so he's going to have to slow down and wait for the person to go back and grab the next water, which could give me 2 or 3 metres. So I went in, grabbed the water, threw it on my face, grabbed the next water, threw it down my throat, and then accelerated, and that was the gap. And I still, and that was 4 years ago, but I still vividly remember grabbing that last water, cup of water, throwing it in my mouth and going, this is it, and pushing, going, there's no looking back. This is, honestly, Chris, this is every single track session you've ever done in your life. This is every single day you've been away from your family. This is for Mum. This is for Sean. This is everything in your life is right now. This minute, it's never been more real than right now. Do not look back and commit. It's 10 minutes of your life. And I was running along the bottom. I was too scared to look back. I was so exhausted. If I looked back, I was fearful I was going to trip over my feet. And I'm running along the flat section up sort of Kuakini before you turn right down Halualai Road and onto Alihi Drive. And Eric Gilson, he's always giving, he's been on the motorbike for years, giving everybody the split. And they're not allowed to give favour anybody. And I've known Eric for years.
Right.
And I've said to him on the motorbike, Eric, can you see him? He's got the whiteboard with the times. And he said, Macca, you know the rules. I can't tell you that I can't see him. These are the rules. And I'm like, yes, I knew then. I turned right, I celebrated.
Sure.
It was the most amazing 5 minutes of my life. You know, yeah, I enjoyed all the way down. I turned right onto a leafy drive. But, you know, and amazing things go through your head. I remember Mark Allen when he first won, watching that turn. I've watched so many people on videos make that turn. And in 07, I don't remember making the turn. I don't remember a leafy drive. I remember nothing. In 2010, I remember everything. Everything. People, just the elation. I was in such good shape. Like, not shape, but I was so alert.
Yeah.
And it was just a beautiful, beautiful win. You know, just an amazing, amazing win. And it was just a relief. And honestly, it was that single race has given me the contentness in my career.
Yes.
To stay so engaged and loving of the sport. I have no animosity. I'm so content from triathlon. I'm so happy with everything it's given me and so proud of myself for pursuing a race that gave me so much difficulty and pursuing a dream I had because I was inspired by guys I wanted to emulate. And I encourage my kids and everyone to do that. When something inspires you and you're driven by passion, it can change your life. It can really change your life.
Reverse the roles. You're chasing Andreas Rehler and you're catching him. Do you ever go side by side with that guy or do you sit on him or go by him?
In my opinion, when you're better off sitting back.
You're going faster. You've got the edge.
You got the edge. And the advantage of being the chaser is the person leading can't see you. And when you can't see someone, you don't know what's happening. So you always play that card for as long as possible.
Right.
You play the element of surprise. But surprise is everything. So when you make the pass and you make it with commitment. So you either don't run up on them, and sit back there and wait and wait and wait until you're closer to the finish, or when if you do run up on them, you run straight by them.
Right.
And we talked about it today, Andreas and myself. I asked him, if you had it again, would you run past? Would you run past? He's like, you never get that chance. So I've never tried to think about it. But yeah, if I had the chance again, I'd run straight past. But I don't have that chance again. And I remember saying it, I think I said it to you, Bob, you were one of the first people I saw when I crossed the finish line. And I said, you know, there's one race in his life that'll run through his head and it's the one that he'll think that got away. And I think that'll be his race in his life. It's the one that got away.
Yeah. Macca, thank you so much for taking so much time. It's always fun to travel down a little memory lane with one of the legendary guys in the sport. I would be remiss. So after the 2010 win, and I love how everything comes full circle, going back to getting the snub for the Olympic team in 2000, and then not going to 2004, then deciding really at the as an older athlete, as a late 30s athlete, deciding, hey, I'm going to go and try to make the Olympic team in 2012. What I love about that was, again, back to your roots, get back to the short distance. What did you learn from that experience?
I learned that the next wave of athletes are remarkable.
Yeah.
remarkable is an understatement. They're above and beyond what I ever thought was possible in triathlon, and that I'm proud that I, for myself personally, it was chasing what I was always driven by, chasing things that felt, like you said, impossible to do or that I wanted to do. To walk away as a world champion in probably your biggest money-making year post the world championship, you can make all the big money from appearance fees. I didn't care. I wanted to take my kids to an Olympic Games if I could. And I met a new wave of kids, a new wave of guys that were remarkable, that are now coming across. You're now seeing these guys come across the Ironman, and they're doing amazing things. You know, Jan Frodeno this year was third on debut in Kona, and Kimi's been here for a few years. But these guys are amazing athletes, and I just enjoyed. Enjoy is probably the wrong word. I didn't enjoy getting my butt kicked on a daily basis by these guys, but I was just amazed at how far. You know, it's the 25th anniversary of ITU racing. You know, 89 when Mark Allen won the first of the year. And Aaron Baker. And, you know, to see what these kids do now, and I call them kids, they're 23, you know, it's mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing. Dropping sub-29-minute runs off aggressive bike rides. People are saying it's draft legal. It's still aggressive. And, you know, they're swimming like fish, and they're just truly, truly the best multi-sport athletes I've ever seen. I love being a part of it. I love meeting a lot of these young kids. A lot of them are now my friends. I try and help a lot of them as they make their transition to 70.3. And I think for a lot of them, for them, they saw me as an old dinosaur. They had no understanding of Ironman racing, and especially for the young Australians, a lot of them are doing it now. Josh Amberger and these sort of guys have come across because I was drilling them about understanding what the sport is, how they got to this circuit they're on. Where did this come from? For many of them, they didn't even know. They never even heard of Mark Allen. They never even. I'm like, guys, I used to, you know, drill them on the history of the sport. Like, hey, mate, this is what happened. This is the guy, and before him, it was this guy, And now I speak to them, and they're actually keen to know more about it, which I love, especially the young Aussie guys. And I love that. I've said it to you many times. I've said it to a lot of the guys I train with. Why am I still here? I will never leave triathlon. I didn't come to triathlon to be a world champion. I had these dreams of doing it. You never expect it. I came to triathlon because I liked it. It challenged me. I enjoyed the people. I enjoyed the racing. I love waking up early on a Sunday morning and going and doing a little sprint race and just going to have breakfast after race and talking the war stories. That, to me, is an amazing day. That to me, I couldn't think of a better day. Sitting after a race, talking about the event, what happened in everyone's day. I just love that. And that happens whether you're at the front of a race or at the back of a race because they're difficult. And that's why we do it. And I'll be here until my knees give in, my hips give in, and even then I'll have a crack at trying to do it. I just love it. I love everything about it.
You'll be out there in your walker, just like me.
Yeah, you'll be with me, Bob.
Exactly.
You're at all the races anyway. Yeah, I love it. I just really, really enjoy the sport. I feel blessed that you guys invented it to some degree, that someone had the brains to think, why don't we swim, bike, and run? And that sport culminated into the phenom that it is today and gave me a life that is just incredible. Incredible.
Yeah. Macca, you're the best. Thank you so much for taking so much time.
No worries, Bob. Always a pleasure.
All right.
Always a pleasure.
This is Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. Our guest has been the great 2-time Ironman world champion, Mr. Chris McCormick. We're brought to you by California 1020. 10 miles, 20 bands coming up Sunday, February 15th. Del Mar Fairgrounds, Encinitas, and back. Core Sports, the very best in women's athletic wear. And Tripalooza, our endurance sports awards gala, coming up on Saturday night, February 21st, Hilton San Diego. That's tri-palooza.com. Come join us. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.